Experts claim there is nothing tougher than a diamond. But at Diamonds Direct, we beg to differ. Have you ever met a mother? Strong, radiant, timeless. This Mother's Day, give her the gift that meets her match. With diamond jewelry starting at $200, plus Diamonds Direct's exceptional quality and unbeatable everyday price, you're sure to give her a gift that wows this generation and the next to come. Experience the thrill of jewelry shopping done right at Diamonds Direct. Diamonds Direct. Your love, our passion.
Welcome to The Hidden Djinn, a production of iHeartRadio and Grim and Mild from Aaron Mankey.
Hi and welcome to this very special bonus series of The Hidden Djinn, The Interviews. In these episodes, you'll hear me talk to people from all walks of life who have had djinn experiences, are drawn to the stories of djinn, and draw lessons from these stories. You'll hear from artists, scholars, writers, journalists, and djinn exorcists, and even from me, as I discuss how and why this series came about in a very personal conversation with my husband. Thanks for listening and enjoy. I am very excited to introduce my guest for you this week, an artist like no other that you have ever known. Mohreshin Aliyari is an artist, activist, writer, and educator. She was born and raised in Iran and moved to the U.S. in 2007, and her work deals with the political, social, and cultural contradictions that we face every single day. She's an acclaimed artist, the recipient of the Joan Mitchell Foundation Painters and Sculptors Grant, the Sundance Institute New Frontier International Fellowship, and Leading Global Thinkers of 2016 Award by Foreign Policy Magazine. Her work has been part of numerous exhibitions, festivals, and workshops around the world, including the Whitney Museum of American Art, Pompidou Center, Museum of Contemporary Art in Montreal, the Tate Museum, the Queen's Museum, Powerhouse Museum, the Dallas Museum of Art, and so many more. Now, I came across Mohreshin when I was researching female djinns, and I came across her incredible project called She Who Sees the Unknown. And in this project, Mohreshin uses 3D scanning, modeling, and printing to recreate monstrous female and queer figures from Middle Eastern origins. Believe me, this is a conversation you don't want to miss. Thank you so much for joining us, Mohreshin. It's a real pleasure to talk to you. I have been fascinated with your work ever since I discovered it earlier this year.
Hi, thanks so much for having me, Rabia. It's an honor.
So, this conversation series is a companion to the ongoing series, which will have aired by the time this airs, called the Hidden Djinn Podcast. And I drew on a lot of different sources. And one of the sources actually was the exhibit that I found, and that's how I discovered you, called She Who Sees the Unknown. But before we get into that, I want to talk a little bit about, you say on your website about this exhibit that in Iranian traditions, djinn are fearsome and honored, and that your upbringing in Iran was full of ancient mythical narratives involving supernatural beings, and your bedtime stories told to you by your grandmother often included djinn. So I wanted to ask you if you could tell us a little bit about your upbringing, about your background in Iran, and about the djinn lore that you grew up with.
Yes. So I started to kind of become interested in general since like 3.5 years ago in these figures of monstrous female / genderless queer figures in mythical stories that would origin in West Asia or basically Middle Eastern ancient stories. And to kind of give you a little bit of, I guess, more summary of also like my practice in relationship to that. I also have been very interested in this relationship between technology and history in that sense. So when I was doing this research, I was going through a lot of resources and books and material that would, you know, include this also like figure of djinn within Islamic tradition and studies. And so that's when I became interested in like researching more into the figure of the djinn. And as you mentioned, it's a figure that I grew up with in Iran. Whenever there were stories that kind of were ghostly stories, etc., it would always involve the figure of the djinn. And so a lot of people who might have grown up in different countries, Islamic countries or Middle Eastern countries, probably also identify with this, that djinn is a figure that we grow up with in a lot of our stories, bedtime stories. And at the same time that is very feared as a figure, it's also very respected. So people take certain kind of caution or like certain kind of care in terms of the way they deal with the djinn and the way that you shouldn't interrupt certain spaces, or you kind of can use different methods as a way to not be possessed by the djinn. So yeah,
go on, please.
So for me, the figure of the djinn had this personal relationship that I had with it, but at the same time, I was also like coming to it from more of like a feminist perspective and feminism studies, and that's something that I guess I can talk more about later.
Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit about what your perspective on these stories were as you grew up, and maybe how that's changed with adulthood. I also, you know, I grew up steeped kind of in this culture, although in my family nobody totally told stories much. But you know, a couple of Muslim kids get together, and that was the topic conversation often late at night. So when you were being taught or told these stories, were they kind of like lessons that were being told to you? Were they told to you to entertain or to maybe warn you from certain behaviors? Or was it taught to you as something like, look, this is real. Like, you got to take this seriously.
I think it's a combination of a couple of those things you said. So most of it, as you also mentioned, it was told by my grandmother who lived with us, and you know, I had a very close relationship to. And one of the most vivid memories I have is in a summer and evening, almost like night when the stars were out, and it was me and two of my cousins who we all lived in the same apartment building, and my grandmother was telling us about her encounter with a djinn at a public bath where she grew up, which is a village in Kurdistan in west of Iran. Mm-hmm. And she was telling us, you know, how it was very common for women who would go to these public bathhouses to encounter djinn. And one of the things that is also known or like talked about the djinn is that they really like spaces that are dark and humid. So basically, you know, a place like a bathhouse is like a perfect place for them to come and visit. So for me, it was kind of like as a child, it was a mixture of believing it and doubting it. Like, did she really see it? Was it something else she saw that like she thought it's a djinn? But again, like, because those stories get like repeated so much within different people's experiences of encountering djinn, it's kind of like becomes almost like an oral narrative of, you know, a relationship with this supernatural creature that is there. And then certain people encounter it and certain people don't. And if you're scared of it, then as I mentioned earlier, you can take certain actions to avoid it.
Were you ever aware? And I wasn't aware until adulthood, and I did, you know, my research kind of more deeply into this whole subject, that djinn are gendered. And that there is a body of, you know, folklore around female djinn in particular, or at least people encounter them as female djinn. Was that something you were aware of growing up, or is that something you also learned as you started doing your research into this project?
Absolutely not. My image of the djinn as this creature was always male. And again, this goes back to one of the reasons I became really curious and also interested in this project that I worked on for almost 4 years, She Who Sees the Unknown, which I wanted to kind of find these female or almost genderless stories and figures of the djinn, and also like monstrous figures, because also growing up in Iran with a lot of mythical and, you know, ancient stories that are part of our daily life, but also our, you know, school and like literature and education.
Incredible all stories. Incredible stories.
Yeah. And they're all always very, you know, all these figures are male. So I was wondering, like, where are the female figures, or where are the figures that are perhaps like more queer, more like non-binary in terms of, like, you know, gender as like this thing that, you know, in English we're like very specific about he and she, but in Farsi actually there's no he or she for third person, right? So I kind of like wanted to find also that ambiguity within these texts and material. And yeah, that's how I came across so many female or genderless figures of Jin that were illustrated in different books and resources and material that I had no idea about.
Can you tell us a little bit about the exhibit? Again, it's titled She Who Sees the Unknown, about the kind of, like the medium that you used for this exhibit. I mean, it's, and I wish I could, I don't know. Where is it being displayed right now, by the way?
So it's more of like a project. I mean, it has been exhibited in so many different places. But when you go to the website, shewhosees.com, it's a research-based project that has many different components and elements, from performance to these 3D printed sculptures that I recreate from illustrations I find in older material, books, etc., to these new texts and narratives that I write about each of these figures that I choose to work with. And then there's an archive aspect of it, and also like a reading room that I have been also working on as part of the project. So, yeah, the project itself, again, has many, many different components. And then the exhibition, anytime I've shown it, it has, you know, taken many, many different forms. But within the research I've done, I've come across many, many texts and material and illustrations, but I've chosen to focus on five specific figures, which are Huma, who is a djinn who brings fever to human body, Yajuj Majuj, who are these figures that are kind of like monsters, djinn-like, that are spoken in the Quran, that represent chaos, the laughing snake, which is known as, you know, a very like powerful kind of hybrid animal, human, female, human combination, that is known as, you know, this figure that is very strong and is going through all these like towns and cities and killing people and eating all the animals, and no one can win a war with her until someone comes and say the only way to kill her is to hold a mirror in front of her. And when she sees her reflection, she starts laughing, and she laughs for days and nights until she dies from the laughter. And then Kabus, which is a djinn that is known as a djinn that brings nightmare and sleep paralysis to human body. And then Aisha Kandisha, which is actually originally a Moroccan djinn that is known to possess a man, creating a crack on their body, and the only way to not go insane when you're possessed by her is to participate with her and listen to her. So I use all these, you know, really beautiful, complex stories, and then I write new stories about them. I turn them around. I kind of connect different aspects of, you know, their power into different contemporary issues and topics, and also kind of these like futuristic alternative reimagination of what's possible in the world.
Right. You've coined this term refiguring, which I read about. Yes. And you said the refiguring is about activation and preservation. Can you talk a little bit about refiguring, and when you think about refiguring, or when you go about it, is the content, because I know, I mean, a lot of your work is, it has a social political, aspect to it. I know in this exhibit, we're going to talk about specifically, you just turned the story of Yajuj Majuj on its head for me. But you know, a lot of it vis-a-vis like, colonization and imperialism, but also, are you also doing the refiguring within kind of your own cultural context?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think the most important aspect of that is the refiguration of this figure of the female, monstrous female figure, which is known usually as like negative or mean, which is kind of like you can compare it to, you know, the figure of the witch in like Western literature and like kind of like cultural productions, which has been turned around through like different feminist movements as something that, instead of like being considered, you know, like this like figure of an old, ugly woman into like a kind of witchcraft movement, which is like empowerment for like women to turn around that figure. So that's something I'm doing within the cultural context of these stories and also the figures themselves, which is to, you know, especially like, I mean, I can give you like an example with, let's say, the laughing snake, which I am kind of turning around this idea that her death because of her laughter is considered a weakness. And I'm saying that actually that position that she's taking is a position of, empowerment, because she's taking away her reflection from the mirror that is held by these men, as you see in this like old illustrations in two different resources. And kind of then I use that to tell a more contemporary story of growing up in Iran and dealing with sexual harassment and, trying to figure out my body as a woman and thinking about sexual desire. And so kind of, again, trying to like find ownership of my body as a woman, but also it's an experience that is very collective in terms of like all women growing up in Iran can connect to these stories and these experiences within street harassment, but also in a wider, again, connection to it. It's something that all women can connect to and with in different levels.
So you interpret the laughter, which actually, when I first read about the story, I also kind of did, as something that was empowering.
Yes, absolutely. Because you know, the way it's, I feel like sometimes it's told is more of, you know, she laughs and then she dies and that's the end. And like they find a way to kill her. But then again, for me, she make the decision, her laughter as a response to what they're doing is like a, very conscious decision of how to respond to that reflection that she's witnessing being held by these men. So, again, like this idea of refiguration or turning around power structures is something that I became really interested in within this project, and how I can do that through specifically also storytelling and a narrative that has political, cultural components to it.
I want to talk about Gabus. I thought, and I've spent a lot of time on your website. I've watched pretty much all the videos on there. And so Gabus are, and they're also called Al-Jathum, and they are known to be kind of a race of jinn, kind of a category of jinn that bring different sicknesses and trauma and nightmares. And the depiction is can be quite frightening. This jinn is, it looks like they're kind of this hovering above a human being in some of the illustrations I've seen as a person sleeps, bringing nightmares to them. But your narration as it relates to this figure was just really, it was kind of, it really did bring me to tears, because your narration is about the story of your birth and the story of you waiting for your mother as a child to land every time she flew. So could you tell us about that story and how the Gabus lore resonates with it?
Gabus was one of the figures that I had come across within my research, and I was kind of like held it somewhere in my head to kind of come back to. And she's the last figure from this series that I worked on. As you mentioned, Gabus is known as a djinn that brings nightmare, but also specifically sleep paralysis to human body. We also said in Farsi, it's also known as Bakhtak, which is kind of like known as this thing that kind of, you know, sits on your chest and won't let you move. I kind of started doing a lot of research first, like within also like this, the scientific aspect of it, like what happens when you experience sleep paralysis. I don't know if you've ever experienced that. Have you ever experienced sleep paralysis?
I have not, but my husband has, and he has described it as a djinn to me. That's what he believes it was.
I've experienced it three times in my life. And I think like most of those three times I was really like stressed for like different reasons. And they say kind of like from the scientific aspect of it, stress also like has, you know, very kind of direct relationship to how you experience this and why you experience it. But that djinn experience that your husband is talking about is actually also very present in a way that you experience sleep paralysis when you're sleeping. My first time that I experienced it, I literally saw someone opening the window, but I saw myself seeing them. So that's another thing that happens, again, within what happens in your brain, if you study it within scientific research, is that you become an image, and then you will be standing outside of that image, then watching yourself. And I experienced it completely like that. And that's really scary because you see yourself not being able to move while you're awake. So anyway, I've been always like fascinated by that because I also had like this personal experience. And I ask people sometimes, you know, about like, have you ever experienced this? What was your experience with sleep paralysis if you did? So thinking about that and thinking about kind of like, basically trauma, right? A lot of papers written on sleep paralysis, as I said, is connected to stress and trauma. Mm. And so I was like thinking about trauma, and I was like doing like a lot of research in this recent scientific, also like research that is this idea of intergenerational trauma, which is that trauma stays in your DNA, basically, and it can be passed on within generations. Some people also call it like blood memory, you know, so like the experience of enslaved people, let's say, to the experience of war, to like other experiences that has been experienced to, again, different generations, it can be passed on. Even if you don't experience it yourself as a new generation, it still kind of stays within your DNA and your blood memory. So I was fascinated by those. These are, again, like newer research and scientific studies. And I wanted to somehow connect this relationship between trauma, intergenerational trauma, to also my ideas of, you know, when we experience intergenerational trauma, like as a person, you know, who is like now like 35, I think about birthing a lot, and I think about children a lot, but also not wanting to have my own child. And so I connect this story to like four generations of women. So my grandmother, my mother, myself, and an imagined monstrous, like djinn-like daughter. And then we all, in different parts of this VR film, we tell different stories about motherhood and war and different trauma and different encounter with djinn. So, and all of this happens in a bathhouse. As I said at the beginning of this conversation, my grandmother always talked about bathhouses, and also public bathhouses at a time were really important social spaces for women and intimacy between women. Right. So women would go and spend hours, you know, at a bathhouse, to bath, but also to hang out and sing and gossip. So this space of intimacy was something I wanted to bring together these four generations of women for us to talk about different relationship we've had with trauma, and then war being a big part of me growing up in Iran, and like this diary that my mom gave me when I was around 16 or 17 that she wrote during Iran-Iraq war when she was pregnant with my sister. And somewhere in it, she talks about how she feels guilty for giving birth to my sister. And she doesn't know if it's the right decision and if it's a cruel decision. And so that always stayed with me, you know, as a teenager, it always stayed with me because I would also kind of ask my parents, or like tease them and saying like, how could your generation give birth to this many kids, because the 8 years of war had actually the highest rate of birth. And, you know, again, like connecting that to my own experience of thinking about motherhood, but like rethinking motherhood and thinking about birthing as something that could be, you know, birth justice is a specific word that I use in that narrative.
Right. Talk about that.
Which is not just, I mean, the definition of birth justice is having the choice of, you know, as a woman, having a choice of when, with who, and I'll say that again in a second, but I'm trying to, wait, is it like who? No, let's see.
I believe you also said where. Yeah.
I guess it is where. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. So let me say that again.
Sure.
So this, I came across this, you know, kind of very specific definition of birth justice, which is that as a woman having the option to choose when, with whom, and where to give birth. And I added to that what to give birth to, you know, as my own kind of imagined way of thinking about how to break through this intergenerational trauma cycle, right? And kind of like the only way in it, I say the only way to break through this cycle is to reimagine the possibilities of what we give birth to. And in this, you know, fictional story that I'm kind of building within the VR film, I'm birthing kind of like a monstrous gen mix of, like, you know, a child that is human and non-human at a time. But kind of, again, within thinking about monstrosity as something that can be a position of empowerment, like embracing that monstrosity or the figure of the jinn, this child is able to see the future for us and help us to build an alternative kind of future, you know. So it's, again, sits between like a real fictional and non-fictional, more like documentary style film. But for me, as you also like mentioned earlier, it's kind of like finding these stories and then connecting them to something that is very personal and also at the same time, you know, again, can be expanded to other people's experiences.
Well, that film and that particular exhibit, I think it was jarring to me in many ways. Also, hearing the voice, the childlike monster voice, you know, there's a real frightening aspect, of course. I mean, like, you know, jinn are supposed to be frightening. They inspire fear in us. But I feel like you're using that fear in a very different way. Can you talk a little bit about what you think, whether there's instrumental, whether you are instrumentalizing the fear in a specific way to mean something else, that not necessarily like the fear means that these monstrous beings are evil necessarily, because, you know, there's a strong connection between jinn evil, especially the jinn that we are told, if the jinn encounter human beings, the lore is, and those are definitely evil jinn.
Yes. Yes. So, I mean, that's a really great question, because the way that I have tried to build this project and kind of build and refigure these stories and figures is to find perhaps like a balance between this hybrid aspect of what jinn are. So they're both feared and honored, right? So they can be your friend and at the same time your enemy. You can befriend them and use their power, like that's what they're known as, right? If you know how to like befriend a jinn and like use their power, you can use that power to possess other beings or like make something happen within the world, right? But also you can be possessed by them. So there's always this sort of gray area with the figure of the jinn. And even in the Quran, when they're talked about, you know, we have the figure of the angel that obeys and then the devil that disobeys. And like humans, jinn have the will to obey or disobey. And that's something that made working with the figure of the jinn really interesting for my research and this body of work. So yeah, I try to kind of build a space where they're feared, but at the same time, we want to know them. We want to get to know them. We want to enter their world. And within the, as I mentioned earlier, the kind of the feminist movements and the feminism refiguration of them, I try to like use their figures as a way to again like find a space for the empowerment of women and non-binary people, etc. So it's really a mix of these worlds that I try to like bring together, and also channel this power of the djinn for our empowerment.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Live Nation presents Concert Week. Now through May 14th, get $25 tickets to over 5,000 shows. That's up to 75% off a summer full of your favorite artists like 21 Savage, Alanis Morissette, Cage the Elephant, Celeste Barber, Dierks Bentley, Fade, Hootie and the Blowfish, Janet Jackson, Kidz Bop Kids, Meghan Trainor, Bissell Pluma, Sarah McLachlan. Get tickets to more than 5,000 summer shows for just $25. Until now through May 14th. Visit LiveNation.com/Concert Week to learn more and plan your summer with Sean Paul, Sum 41, 30 Seconds to Mars, oh, and Two Door Cinema Club.
One of the questions that I pose in, there's one specific episode that focuses on the female djinn. And one of those djinn that's heavily focused on is Aisha Khadija, who has a really rich, I mean, there's so much tradition around that figure. But not the other ones that you actually have included in your exhibit. But one of the questions I pose is, you know, as I was reading these stories, I wondered, you know, I can see it playing both ways with these stories, which in large part, at least in South Asian culture, we don't have access to stories of female djinn anymore. These don't exist anymore. I've never heard them anymore, unless they are like an unnamed witch type of figure, right? Mm-hmm. Or something that's not as, not as powerful like as a Aisha Khadija or a Lilith or other kinds of female figures. But I've always wondered, were the perceptions around female djinn, do you think, a reflection of how society viewed women? You know, we have this, I mean, it's not uncommon to hear in a lot of Muslim cultures that, oh yeah, women are bent, a little bit crooked, like the rib of Adam, because they come from the rib of Adam. So there's something a little nefarious about women. Or I wondered, are these stories of djinn, these female djinn who have so much power and can inspire so much fear, are these actually projections of the women at the time themselves saying, this is what we are capable of, and you should hold a little fear and love and respect all at the same time?
Yeah, I like to think that's like a big part of it, the one that you just mentioned, but also I'm pretty sure it's a combination of two, pretty much, you know, within looking at a lot of these stories and kind of like also, again, like one thing I've been doing and researching is also the parallel world of Western like figures or methodologies and how they've been used within different like feminist movements, right? Like, as I mentioned, the figure of the witch, or the you know, we have the figure of the zombies, which can be male or female. But definitely, I think something that I have been fascinated by is that kind of patriarchal, you know, heaviness of like how these figures are like, not just that women are like, you know, from, as you say, there's like that saying that women actually within some Islamic cultures and thinking that are like even like considered half of men, right? They're that incomplete.
And actually, to be fair, look, it's not just, I mean, the Abrahamic, I mean, you know,
absolutely.
I mean, like original sin, right? I mean, like how Christianity,
right,
and Judaism, it exists, I would say, even non-Abrahamic cultures, but certainly.
Absolutely, yeah. Exactly. Like, so that's my research within like other cultures and studies shows exactly what you're saying, that like that like patriarchal kind of like perspective toward like women, their madness, their like hysteria, right? There's a long history of hysteria and patriarchy within like women having this hysteria or madness for different reasons. When you like, there's a whole Wikipedia page on hysteria.
Well, America still thinks that a woman is not emotionally stable enough to become president. So
and we have that within, you know, in Iran, for example, you can't be a judge as a woman because, or you are too emotional to be able to like judge with logic, basically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
So I want to talk, I have to say this, you know, I'm always I'm an observant Muslim, but I have had to rediscover my faith in the last 15, 20 years, because I realized that the gatekeepers who were teaching us things have a very specific perspective, it's just the male perspective. It's a very patriarchal, misogynistic perspective. And so retelling the stories in a way that actually makes sense to the spirit of what I believe is a lot of faith is about, has really opened up a lot of doors for me. But this retelling of Yajuj Majuj, I cannot tell you. I can't stop thinking about this. And I'm going to talk about this with every other person I meet. But for our listeners, you might not be familiar with Yajuj Majuj, but you might be familiar with Gog and Magog, which is found in the biblical telling and the Talmudic telling, the Torah telling. And Gog and Magog are a race of beings that it is said, at least I can speak more specifically in the Islamic tradition, that they are basically hidden behind a wall. They cause chaos. They are these beings that if they're unleashed into the world, they'll destroy it. So for centuries and millennia, they have been buried behind this wall. Every single day, they chip away at this wall. And at the end of the day, they give up and say, well, we just can't get through. But the next day, they start over again. And as the story goes, towards the end of time, towards the day of judgment, at one point, they're going to breach the wall and completely be unleashed on this world. But oh my gosh, you have to tell me how you imagine the story in your own words.
Absolutely. Yeah, so I came actually across this story sometime after the Muslim ban or travel ban had happened in the US. And I myself was also affected by it. At a time, I had left the US for a week of exhibitions and conference that I was part of in Berlin, in Germany. And then the ban happened. And at a time, I had an Iranian passport and a green card. And if some of you might remember, at the beginning, green card holders were also like included with the ban, and from if you were from these six banned countries. It was like such a strange, complicated moment where I just didn't know if I could come back to the US. And, you know, I've lived here for like now around 11, 12 years. And so that was like a really intense moment of realizing everything I'd built here could just go to zero. But obviously I was privileged enough to have the green card and be able to come back, while this story up to today, 4 years later almost, is very relevant to the lives of many people who are trying to come to this country for different reasons, as immigrants, refugees, etc. And so I came across the story of Yajuj Majuj, and you know, this image of the wall was something that was just stuck in my head, because it talks about the wall as something that they get this figure, Zolgarin, in some texts they say it's Alexander the Great,
right,
to build this wall. And the people of the city ask for this wall to be built to keep Yajuj Majuj out, because they represent chaos, as you also mentioned. And so I started to do a lot of research around it, like reading different interpretations of this story, not just within, you know, the Islamic text itself, but different interpretations of different, you know, Muslim scholars, or just people reading the story and coming up with their own interpretation of what this means. And one thing that was really fascinating to me is kind of these different time zones and timelines of how Yajuj Majuj, or who Yajuj Majuj had been interpreted as. So some were like, oh, they were you know, Turkish people or Mongolians who attacked Iran. Some were like, you know, again saying they represent Israel, and you know, and again many other interpretations of them. But one thing that became very obvious to me is how through many centuries of this story being interpreted, it shows that we always have found this figure of the other, right? Mm. Or the othered, as a way to make a monster of. So what basically someone like Trump calls the bad people, and you know, the ones that can put America in danger, or like we don't want to let them come in because
the rapists, the worst ones, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how true this monstrosity of these people, right? Like making a monster of these people through so many years, including the moment we're living, the other have been justified as those we need to keep out, those we need to ban, those we need to reject. And the Islamic interpretation is that when the Ya'juj Ma'juj come and break through the wall, we're going to, you also mentioned, experience some kind of ending. And as you know, within Islamic studies, that ending is both dystopian and in some ways utopian, because the ending itself is dystopian, but it will result to basically something that we want, that is better, right? So and they use this very specific term, which is the end of time, that they doesn't say like in and they kind of, I mean, I read a lot about that specific frame, which is the end of time. And yeah, that was just really powerful for me, because I was like, what would the end of this time mean to us right now, as, you know, as Muslim, as people from, you know, even if you're not, I mean, it's about nationality at this point, right? If you're from Iran, sure, but whatever your religion is, and other countries that are also banned as well. So it's like, what would that end mean? And also for all these other people, you know, we're now in the past weeks, there has been a lot of conversations and kind of protests, etc., about Black people and the struggle of Black people in America and the history of slavery, etc. So doesn't matter how you're othered within this context of history, but the fact that the otherness is almost always linked to this monstrosity was something that was really fascinating to me. So I turned around again like that image and used the power of the chaos, the monstrous, the one that is the othered, as a way to actually break through the wall and then wish for some new beginning, another world, an alternative reality that we can live in that is not whatever it is that we're experiencing now.
You're telling us that the chaos that we fear, or that's feared by certain powers, we ourselves have internalized fear of that chaos, when that chaos itself could bring the end of a time that's terrible for those of us who are othered, and could usher in, you know, whatever comes after the end of this time. And it's just such a an eye-opening, and I have to think about this for a long time and talk about this with a lot of people, but I also thought it was really wonderful that you collectively imagined Ya'juj and Ma'juj as this female figure, and you said that she felt the burden of her people's exhaustion upon her shoulders, the exhaustion of constantly trying to break through the wall, and yet not giving up.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I was writing it, it was, again, very personal, but I was like horrified. And at the same time, I knew that I have the privileges that a lot of people don't have. So kind of like thinking about Ya'juj Ma'juj, thinking about that story as a story that becomes a portal in talking about and representing the pain of all these people who are being othered and being banned and being rejected literally most times for no reason. So that was something that became, yeah, very heartbreaking and at the same time painful to think about and write about.
It just really made me think about who we are taught to fear, and to examine that a little more closely. And it really brought to mind in how, you know, right post the post-Civil War, where there was like this explosion of fear around Black men attacking white women. Yeah. And with Birth of a Nation, I mean, movies, all kinds of media, newspapers, and how we are systematically taught to fear something unquestioning, without question. And so this, you have taught me to question maybe what it is that we've been taught to fear. And I think one of the things I love about how you framed this entire project is that the female jinn not only has seen the unknown and the known, but she's embraced being the other.
Absolutely. And that's something that I also try to use on my daily life and my practice of not shying away from, you know, wanting to constantly justify myself that I'm worthy, I'm good. And I, you know, because of this reason or that reason, I am worthy of either, you know, living in this country or like having access to certain kind of resources, etc. But kind of, again, like rather embracing the otherness and using it as a way to criticize that very, very thing that has been, you know, again, othering us.
Hmm. Okay, I'm going to end with one last question for you. But before that, I just want to say thank you for this incredibly illuminating conversation, for your work. I'm going to continue to follow it. I'm so excited to have discovered it. And we will point all our listeners in that direction too, so they can continue to follow you. And my last question for you is this. Do you believe you have ever personally had an experience with jinn?
I think that the ones,
however you might think of jinn, I mean, it doesn't have to, it can be whatever you, jinn is in your imagination. Let me clarify.
Right. Yeah. I mean, so there are two things I can say. One is that the actual experiences of that I was telling you of these kind of nightmare sleep paralysis, which you literally feel like there is, it's not just like a nightmare, that there is another third person with you in that space, right? So it's like you and the jinn and also something else, you know, with the jinn. So it's that experience of the sleep paralysis has been really intense and has stayed with me always. And since I also started working on this project, you know, again, I grew up in Iran with a lot of these jinn related stories, etc. But it was not until when I started to do this body of work, Shihus is the Unknown, that I like really had to, you know, spend a lot of hours researching. And also that caused like very real relationships that I had built with each of these figures, right? Like I sometimes call them like my children, these like five figures that I, you know, mentioned their names earlier that I have worked on. Because to work on each of them, I had to spend like hours, not just researching their history and the stories told about them, but also like writing about them and really trying to like imagine this thing as something that I'm like using its power to do something else with, right? And this like really became, yeah, like a connection that I never thought I would find with something that I'm creating this intensely. This is all like in that sense very like new to me. I kind of see them not just, as you say, like I'm able to like imagine them also in many other forms and like many, many, many other ways of their presence within like my personal life, as well as what they can do for the world and with the world. And kind of last thing I want to mention is that we really need a figure like the jinn, I think, especially within like these kind of feminist movements and thinking about women and trying to like find something away or like different from the dominant, perhaps like Western white feminism movements. For me, the image of the jinn is something that, you know, I have found it so powerful because also it's something that is for us. But one thing I say that, you know, to build this future for us, but by us, right? And that's something that I think they can do. And so that means that their presence, even when this project is almost done, the She Who Sees the Unknown, but I think their presence in my life will stay in many serious ways, because I will always think about them again as portals, as channels, as friends and allies that can help us get through whatever it is that we're trying to get through as we struggle this very moment.
Thanks for checking out this week's episode and conversation. If you want to learn more about Maura Sheen and her work, you can find her on Twitter at the handle @MauraSheen. It is spelled MauraSheen. Her website is MauraSheen.com, MauraSheen.com. And the exhibit that we talked so extensively about is called She Who Sees the Unknown. And you can find the whole website about the entire project at shewhoseestheunknown.com. Absolutely check it out. Read the reading room, watch the videos. It's amazing.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. Now, there are as many people in the world with djinn stories as there are djinn. So if you have one you'd like to share, make sure to email it to me at thehiddenjinn@gmail.com. That's thehiddenjinn, thehiddenjinn@gmail.com. And until next time, remember, we are not alone.
The Hidden Djinn is a production of iHeartRadio and Grim and Mild from Aaron Mankey. The podcast is written and hosted by Rabia Chaudhry and produced by Miranda Hawkins and Trevor Young, with executive producers Aaron Mankey, Alex Williams, and Matt Frederick. Our theme song was created by Patrick Cortez. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.